Welcome to Yale Cancer Center Answers with your hosts, Drs. Anish Chagpar, Susan Higgins, and Stephen Gore. Dr. Chagpar is Associate Professor of Surgical Oncology and Director of the Breast Center at Smilow Cancer Hospital. Dr. Higgins is Professor of Therapeutic Radiology and of Obstetrics, Gynecology, and Reproductive Sciences. And Dr. Gore is Director of Hematological Malignancies at Smilow and an expert on myelodysplastic syndromes. Yale Cancer Center Answers features weekly conversations about the research, diagnosis, and treatment of cancer. And if you'd like to join in, you can email your questions and comments to canceranswers@yale.edu, or you can leave a voicemail message at 888-234-4YCC. This week, it's a conversation about Edward Cantor's book chronicling his wife's battle with ovarian cancer. Here's Dr. Stephen Gore.
Can you tell us about your wife and her diagnosis?
Well, Mickey was in her early 60s when she was diagnosed. She had retired about 5 years before that and had begun to take courses at Yale and was enrolled in graduate school when she was diagnosed. Her symptoms in the beginning were not, there were no typical symptoms, and that's one of the problems with ovarian cancer. Mm-hmm. They say you may feel some bloating in your stomach. She had none of that. There were some earlier situations which, had we been more aware, I think would have kindled some interest in us in pursuing that may have helped the situation, but we didn't.
Mm-hmm. So how did she come to medical attention?
Well, she had some pain in her back, but she had had chronic back problems. So her doctor at that time, her gynecologist, ordered an ultrasound. And the ultrasound was taken by an independent physician, a radiologist in New Haven.
Sure.
And he said that there was some oxygenation that was apparent, which meant that there could have been a growth of some cellular growth that was being fed by oxygen, and said that we should follow it for 90 days. That could have been interpreted as the development of blood cells, blood vessels. At the end of 90 days, he followed through and said that this requires surgery. Had we been more alert, had the doctor suggested it, a possibility that would have occurred would have been a hysterectomy in the beginning.
Hmm.
Because obviously my wife's ovaries at the age of, in her early 60s at 63, weren't something that she needed.
Well, right. But it sounds like perhaps on the ultrasound, he didn't really see a tumor, it sounds like.
There wasn't a tumor. There was just increased vascularization.
I see. Okay.
And so eventually, soon thereafter, we were sent to the Yale Cancer Center and were told that Mickey was going to be operated on very quickly. She was operated on by Tom Rutherford, who we didn't have a chance to meet before the surgery.
Hmm.
Her gynecologist up to that time told her that it was nothing that progressed to, well, it's something on one ovary. Then her statement to us was that if it's something on one ovary, it's obviously encapsulated, which meant that it had not spread. And
did she indicate that something meant cancer?
Yes, you understood that
something was cancer.
That's what we assumed, although she told us in the beginning that she didn't think it was anything. When they operated, they found that she had cancer on both ovaries, on the omentum, which is located between the two ovaries, and in the fallopian tubes, and all of that was removed.
Hmm. And was that a very shocking thing
totally.
To learn?
Totally. We were not ready for that diagnosis. Mickey was in the hospital. I decided that I needed to tell her right away what had happened. And she was not prepared for it. I was not prepared for it. I told her about the diagnosis. My reaction was shock, anger, disappointment, And I then found out within the next 2 days that she really didn't comprehend what I told her. She was still feeling the effects of the surgery. And that when she next saw her doctor, who was not Dr. Rutherford, it was a doctor covering for him, he told her about the cancer and the spread of the cancer, so that when I saw her the next day and she no longer felt the effects of surgery, she was crying, very emotional and very upset.
Wow. I mean, it sounds like this whole, I mean, the diagnosis of cancer and communication with patients and their families is always a difficult one. It's one of the hardest jobs we have as oncologists. But it certainly sounds like, in retrospect, this whole series of events was not managed in a way that was really optimal for you guys, well, given that it was going to be bad news.
That was before we got to the cancer center, particularly. We dismissed the gynecologist at that time. There had been other episodes. You always think back and think, well, what if? What if you had been aware of certain things? Well, there were two other things. That when Mickey reached menopause, she was given hormone replacement drugs, as many women are, consisting of progesterone and Premarin.
Mm-hmm.
She switched, and she was on it for quite some time. And the general medical feeling is that you don't stay on it forever, that it presents certain dangers. She was aware of the danger. She chose to stay on it because off of it, she reacted very badly to postmenopausal discomfort.
Mm-hmm.
But when she switched gynecologists, there was a mistake, and the gynecologist who eventually told us that her initial diagnosis was nothing kept her on Premarin but forgot to put her on progesterone.
Mm-hmm.
Premarin stimulates cell growth. It thickens the uterine lining. That's the last thing you want. Progesterone counteracts that.
Mm-hmm.
So there were a period of months in which she was only on Premarin and not on progesterone. Now, we can't say that that caused or accelerated anything, but it still is something that certainly wasn't good for her in her situation. So the early management before anything was diagnosed was certainly something that was questionable.
But it sounds like even in the hospital, the primary surgeon, again, not to cast aspersions in any directions, was not as available as one might like, either in terms of pre-op meeting and post-op debriefing for the two of you together.
Well, he would come at 6 o'clock in the morning, and I didn't know that. And Mickey was in a daze. She didn't know who he was because she had never met him.
Mm-hmm.
And so there were several days in which I was very frustrated because I hadn't had a chance to meet him and talk to him and see who he was. There were other people on staff. There was another oncologist who also was a surgeon who was very nice and talked to us during that time and explained things.
Mm-hmm.
We were in a storm. We were taken up in a whirlwind and were carried along by the system. That was very upsetting, particularly for me, who in my life had always been in control of what I was doing and what was happening. And now we were part of the system, and there was not a lot of personal contact in the beginning. That was remedied as her treatment progressed.
Mm-hmm. This was in 2003. Yeah, so certainly before the advent of our Smilo Hospital, where I believe, and having come from another great institution, Johns Hopkins, from where I came, I really do believe that the patient and family experience is really a central focus of the Smilo experience now. We have a really wonderful administration, but it's, I feel like a corporate apology, at least regret, that back then you didn't have that kind of experience.
Well, it's very interesting when Tom Lynch, who has just left as the director of Smilo, read my book. He said to me, "You were too nice to the doctors." Mm-hmm. In my book. I ended up being very grateful to the doctors, and the hospital changed, as you have said. There was a change not just in the cancer treatment, but in the hospital as a whole.
Yes.
And we were really aware of that after 2003, during her treatment, during the long period of her remission, and during her recurrence. It was a much different experience.
So here you are, she's crying, you're feeling lost. What happened after that?
Well, she was told that she would need to have chemotherapy, and we gradually realized how grave the situation was. We learned that 50% of ovarian cancer patients at her level, which was level 3, only 50% survive for 5 years. Mm-hmm. I tended to look at things with the glass half full. Mickey tended to look at things more with the glass half empty. So I was in a position of telling her, well, you're going to be part of the good 50%. And she wasn't so sure about that. About 3 weeks later, we began chemotherapy. And the chemotherapy consisted of 6 sessions, 3 weeks apart.
Mm-hmm.
She tolerated the chemotherapy very well. At the end of each session, she was given Neulasta.
It's a growth factor to stimulate her white blood cells.
Right. And that was the hardest thing for her to handle.
A lot of bony pain, probably.
A lot of pain in her bones. So we planned things that way. We knew that after the chemotherapy, she was going to be okay for 24 hours. Then we would have the Neulasta, and she would have a lot of pain for about 2 days. And then that would subside, so we'd get a period of about 10 days or 2 weeks in which she was weak and then gathered her strength, and we could carry on, and then she would have the next treatment.
Did you think about discussing with the physicians or any of the physician extenders, advanced practice nurse practitioners or whatever, about the Neulasta and whether that could be adjusted or changed to something else? Or you just assumed this was the price of admission?
We tried to ameliorate the pain, and they were giving her things to do that, but they didn't always work.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So 6 cycles of this, so that's over around 4 months, it sounds like.
That's correct.
And then what happened? Then what was the situation?
Well, it's very interesting because the patient does what she's told to do, and that's to follow the medical instructions. And she was doing very well at the end of 18 weeks. She did not register. There's a marker to show you what your levels are, called the CA-125.
Mm-hmm.
And about 10 or 15% of people who have cancer don't register on that standard, and she did not. So we couldn't tell objectively how she was doing. But she felt good. The physical examinations were all positive, and she was told that now we sit and wait. She had, and by that time we had gotten to know her surgical oncologist, Tom Rutherford, who turned out to be a wonderful, wonderful guy. And she was actually given her treatment by Arthur Levy, who was a terrific oncologist, a local oncologist.
Mm-hmm.
We waited. We sat and waited to see what would happen over the next 2 years, which was going to be a marker we were looking for, because if patients have recurrences, they generally happen in the next 2 years.
All right. Well, we're going to have to take a short break for Medical Minute. Please stay tuned to hear more of Ed and Mickey Cantor's story.
This year, over 200,000 Americans will be diagnosed with lung cancer. More than 85% of lung cancer diagnoses are related to smoking, and quitting even after decades of use can significantly reduce your risk of developing lung cancer. Clinical trials are currently underway at federally designated comprehensive cancer centers, such as the Yale Cancer Center and at Smilo Cancer Hospital at Yale New Haven, to test innovative new treatments for lung cancer. Advances are being made by utilizing targeted therapies and immunotherapies. The BATTLE-2 trial at Yale aims to learn if a drug or combination of drugs based on personal biomarkers can help to control non-small cell lung cancer. This has been a Medical Minute brought to you as a public service by Yale Cancer Center and Smilo Cancer Hospital at Yale New Haven. More information is available at yalecancercenter.org. You're listening to WNPR, Connecticut's public media source for news and ideas.
Welcome back to Yale Cancer Center Answers. This is Dr. Stephen Gore, and I'm talking tonight with my guest, Edward Cantor, about his journey through his wife's cancer diagnosis of ovarian cancer over 10 years ago. Ed, I want to make sure we have time to talk about your book and your journey, but perhaps you can summarize what happened when you left us, when we left you before the break. You were mentioning that she had received her chemotherapy. She was being monitored. You were hoping for good news at a two-year mark.
Well, everything went well. We reached 2 years without any further incident, and then the next goal was 5 years. And we continued to have physical examinations by both Dr. Rutherford and Dr. Levy, and Mickey did well. She gathered her strength. She went back to school. She was at that time the oldest graduate school, the oldest graduate student at Yale, and proceeding toward a master's degree. And at the end of 5 years, she was said that generally the standard is that means you're cured.
2008, this would be, or so.
That would be 2008, and 6 months later, she had a recurrence.
And how did you find out about that?
She felt a lump in her stomach, and we had had a previous appointment scheduled with Dr. Rutherford 3 days later, and she went to see him, and you could tell by the look on his face that it was back.
Yeah.
And so he did an immediate CAT scan, said we have to operate. This is really very unusual and very unfortunate, and they opened her up and they found more tumors, a very large tumor pressing against her lung and another one near her liver. So they knew about it through the CAT scans before they went in, and two doctors operated on her at that time.
And were they able to remove most of the cancer then?
They removed everything that was visible, but they didn't know, and obviously they didn't remove it all.
Sure.
Because over the next 2 to 3 years, she at that point began to register on the CA-125
scale. The blood test.
Yeah, and the numbers did not come down sufficiently. It was steadily downhill. There were some really bad incidents. We did a trial with Avastin, which was a drug that was being used.
This was a clinical trial?
A clinical trial she was in. She ended up with very high blood pressure, being rushed to the hospital, having a seizure.
Oh, wow.
Being in a coma for about 4 or 5 days. Ah. So there were a series of misfortunes, and at one point in 2011, at the end of 2010, we were basically told, I was told, that nothing else was going to work, and we had to decide whether to continue to look for the needle in the haystack without much optimism, or to go for quality of life, which is a decision that we made.
Mm. And was hospice involved at that point, or?
There was an early hospice program when we weren't in hospice because we were still in chemotherapy, when Mickey needed help at home. And during that time, they came a couple of days a week. Then at the end of 2010, we went into a full hospice program as an outpatient.
And then when did she pass away?
She passed away on July 7th in 2011.
And did she have some reasonable quality of life in those last months? Or?
She did, and her attitude was terrific because she did not want people to look on her as Mickey the patient. She wanted to be looked on as a real person. What held her back is that because there was an increased tumor again at the base of her lung was compressed, so she needed to be on oxygen all the time.
Mm-hmm.
That meant that basically she was confined to home. But she did the best under the circumstances, and she never complained. And that's what I wrote about.
What led you to write a book about this?
Well, in the beginning, when she was in the hospital back in 2003, I started to keep a journal just mm-hmm. out of my own frustration to write about what was going on. And I did that until she finished her first bout of chemotherapy. Then when she died, I looked at my notes and I said, you know, I think there's something here that other caregivers could use. I was the primary caregiver, and I had never written a book before, so I began to put everything together and put together a manuscript and wrote about it. When I was done, I was a friend of Dr. Sherwin Newland, who wrote an award-winning book called How We Die.
Mm.
And I asked him if he would look at this book. And he said he was going away for vacation for a few weeks, but he'd read it when he came back. Well, the next morning on my email was a message from Dr. Newland that said I was done packing. I was going to read the first few pages. And instead, I read the whole book. I couldn't put it down. You need to publish it. It's very important.
Wow.
And that just was a great incentive and an impetus to me that carried me through refining the book, expanding the book. In the beginning, it was really too clinical. I was relying on the journal. Later on, I added several thousand words and made it much more personal. So it became a personal story. It became a story for caregivers, I think, but it also became a love story.
And when did you publish it?
The book was published about a little over a year ago.
Mm-hmm. And how would people get a hold of it? Is it?
You can get hold of it at Barnes & Noble, at
Amazon?
At Amazon, yeah. At independent bookstores.
Okay.
But it's important. The name of the book is Remember Me Living with Cancer. It's important to use the whole title, Remember Me Living with Cancer, because I found out later that there are several Remember Me's. So you need to go a little further than that, or you need to use my name.
Got it. So you say that this is really a book for caregivers. What are some of the learning points or take-home points, or is it just a question of knowing that there's other people out there who've been undergoing similar experiences and get validation from reading this experience of yours? What do you see as the message for the caregiver?
Well, I recall two questions that were put to me by friends of mine, close friends. One of them was, are you afraid of Mickey dying? That was a question that I was asked early on. And I said, I'm not afraid of her dying, I'm afraid of getting there. And it was this torturous journey that is important to keep in mind that I wrote about. The second question was, do you have any axioms that you take out of the experience that you can repeat to other caregivers? And I thought about that. And the first one is to be there. To be there for your spouse or the person you're giving care to physically and emotionally be present.
Being present, right.
Even if it's just holding hands. The second is to be an advocate, because you're quite in a system that you can't control. And the patient just has to follow the doctor's instructions, but you need to speak up, to question the doctor, to ask questions, to talk to friends, to tell them what's appropriate and what isn't. And I think those are two important things that I carried forward. And the other one is that a cancer death is not like dying from a heart attack. It goes on generally over a period of time.
Yes.
If there's a good thing about a cancer death, it's that you have time to say goodbye. And I tell my friends now frequently, don't wait too long to tell someone you love them. It's really important.
Mm-hmm. A couple of things that you mentioned earlier really struck me. One that you stated, and I don't know if you meant it literally, that the doctors sort of took you aside, it sounds like, to talk to you that about the pathologic diagnosis or surgical diagnosis while your wife was still recovering, and subsequently later on you were told that there was nothing meaningful that could be done. And at least looking at it from a 2016 perspective, or from my personal perspective, it doesn't feel kosher to me. You know, we really believe the patient needs to be the center of the drama and the information. And it feels to me like perhaps you were put in this untenable situation of knowing something she didn't know. And what was that like? Or am I misinterpreting the story?
I think I encouraged the conversation. Early on when she had her recurrence, I talked to Dr. Schwartz at the cancer center, and I asked him, I was asking the questions, Mickey was not, and I said, when you have a recurrence, what are the chances of recovery? And he said, well, it depends on how early you catch the recurrence and whether the treatment that you try in the early stages works, because mm-hmm. the further out you go, the more likely it is that it isn't going to work. Mm-hmm. And so I listened to him and I followed what he said. After going through the trial with Avastin and with a number of other drugs, it appeared to me that we were just going downhill and it wasn't going to change. Mm-hmm. So I sought out one of the doctors and I said, what is going on? Where are we? And he was very honest with me, and he said, I think at some point soon we have to talk about palliative care.
Mm-hmm. And how did Mickey get involved with that conversation?
After I spoke to the doctor, within 24 hours, they spoke to her about palliative care.
So it wasn't put in your hands?
No, it wasn't. And after I knew that they had spoken with her, she and I discussed it more thoroughly, and all the final decisions, all the decisions about her treatment were made by her, but we talked about them together. That was part of our journey.
Great. Well, that's good. I'm glad to hear that, as hard as it must have been. You know, I think you raise really important attention to the important role that the caregiver plays, but also in some ways the kind of loneliness of that position and the burden of responsibility that many caregivers feel or take upon themselves, for better or for worse. And I wonder what kind of support you received as a caregiver. Who were your caregivers during the time? Did you have any? Were the support groups family?
I did. I was really very fortunate. I had a son who lived in the next town, and he was at our house continually. His fiance was there with him. His former wife came to our house continually, and our grandchildren were there, and they were my primary support. And my grandchildren began confronting the disease when they were 7 and 9, mm-hmm. and we didn't know how they would react to it, but they were wonderful. By the time Mickey had died, they were 15 and 17.
Right.
And they were a great source of support for me, as were friends. And you learn during the situation that some friends stand up for you and some disappear. And that's what happens during life. But support was very helpful. On the other hand, they all come during the day, and at night they all go home. Mm-hmm. And what's left is the caregiver and the patient. And it's a lonely existence. But it's an existence that the caregiver takes on.
That's Edward Cantor. We invite you to share your questions and comments. You can send them to canceranswers@yale.edu, or you can leave a voicemail message at 888-234-4YCC. And as an additional resource, archived programs are available in both audio and written form at yalecancercenter.org. We'd like to thank the Yale Cancer Center for providing production support for this program, And we'd also like to thank Renee Gaudette, Emily Fenton, and the staff of the Yale Broadcast and Media Center. I'm Bruce Barber, thanking you for listening to Yale Cancer Center Answers here on WNPR, Connecticut's public media source for news and ideas.